professional cooker. And the people in the tavern next door to the lips are evidently very engaged in this dynamic. And, so,
and it's quiet, so it must be halftime.
Yeah. Everyone's in the bathroom. Okay. Anything else that anyone wants to share with Sangha wise? Okay. Well, when I was last here, among the things that we were talking about together are some of the really powerful teachings that the Buddha has to offer, not just on quieting the mind to be able to see clearly what's going on inside and just being with whatever happens, but then also using that clarity of mind to take a hard look at some of the aspects of existence that he discovered in the course of his spiritual inquiry leading up to his enlightenment, that he felt that it was really important for anyone who wanted to follow his path, who wanted to learn why suffering exists in the world, what role the mind actually contributes to it, and how the cessation of that suffering can be achieved. And so in addition to just blindly watching the arising and passing of all phenomena, the Buddha said, when I did that, what I saw clearly were some aspects of existence that normally you try to avoid taking account of and try to avoid seeing. And these are what we call the three marks of existence, or the three characteristics. Okay. One of them is the characteristic of ceaseless change. Everything is always in flux. That what we see as being stable or secure phenomena are not. That in the universe, the only constant is change. That all phenomena that we encounter, that we see, is in the process of rising and changing and passing away. Another of these three characteristics is that which we take to be solid and substantial and permanent is not. That in addition to everything continuously rising and changing and passing away, because of the state of constant flux, that which we take to be solid or permanent or stable really isn't. It's insubstantial, let's say. And can't be counted upon because it's always changing. So, anicca, ceaseless change. Anatta, insubstantiality. And then the third of these three characteristics that the Buddha noted is because of the fact that the dispersive mind is not amused by the dispersive phenomena, ceases with change and insubstantiality, it causes mental suffering, causes dukkha. And his teaching was that this is basically the way things are. And our difficulties in life to a significant extent arise because we're disinclined to acknowledge that that's how these things are. So it's possible to look at these things as an abstract philosophical construct. It's sure fine. You know, we had this dichotomy, you know, back in the history of science between the Newtonian physicists, you know, who basically came up with the theories to explain stability and certainty. Gauss, Newtonian physics, that Gauss is the moon beyond, right? So it's not as if that's not a realm of reality or understanding physical reality that's significant and is true within its own context. But then we have this whole other realm of theoretical physics that says, well, you know, it's not how things are. It's how things might be some of the time under certain circumstances, right? It's a lot more fluid, and it's a lot more like what the Buddha was talking about when he talked about ceaseless change and when he talked about insubstantiality. So again, it's one thing to look at these as, you know, alternative, you know, kind of constructs of the physical world. But the Buddha said, well, you know, inasmuch as we are, you know, what they call compounded things, you know, entities made up of the material, the matter of the universe and of the environment, we too are subject to these same phenomena. You know, the arising and passing, what we have, it's what, 700,000 cells a second in the body are born and die. You know, and so the body is in the process of constant replication. And given where we are in the life cycle, different organs in the body replicate themselves at different rates. But on average, for a lot of our adult life, the human body completely replicates itself about every 7 years. So it looks right, the same. This is me. I've still got 5 fingers on my right hand, 5 fingers on my left hand, and except for those of us who don't. So we have our many fingers down. But the seeming constancy, the seeming substance, is not all that we might hope it would be. And so the Buddha said, well, in order to ratchet down the understanding of these three characteristics from some abstract philosophical construct to us, let's make it a little more personal. And that's where he came up with this practice he calls the 5 daily recollections. You know, that in order to personalize these three marks of existence, he says, it's useful to, on a regular basis, remind yourself, I am of a nature to age. I have not gotten beyond aging. I'm subject to illness and infirmity. I haven't gotten beyond illness and infirmity. I am of a nature to die. I have not gotten beyond death. All that is mine, dear and delightful, will change and vanish. I am born of my karma. I am heir to my karma. My actions are the womb from which I have sprung. My actions are my relations. My actions are my protection. All of my actions, both wholesome and unwholesome, skillful and unskillful, of these I shall become the heir. So, rather than us just having a look at the three characteristics and as they're kind of, you know, made more personally explicit in the 5 daily recollections, what I wanted to do this evening is to look at these things in relationship to the importance of self-care. So self-care is related to the three characteristics. Self-care in relationship to taking up the 5 daily recollections. So, what do I mean by that? What do I mean by self-care? What I don't mean is some exercise in the reification or reinforcement of a notion of a permanent or abiding self. You know, the perpetuation of the notion of ego. Rather, what I'm referring to here is when we talk about self-care, caring for the state of our spiritual being. You know, just as we try to care for the physical body and keep it healthy and well-nourished and strong and able to make its way through this world, okay? So too is it with regard to our spiritual path and our spiritual well-being. So the reason that on the altar this evening is Kuan Yin, the Bodhisattva of Compassion, in the Chinese of Buddhist tradition, is that in order to skillfully practice contemplation of the three characteristics or the five daily recollections, in order to avoid harming oneself in doing so, in order to take spiritual care of yourself while you're doing these practices, it's really, really important to honor and protect and be with that part of yourself that wants to be free. These can be challenging and sometimes disturbing teachings. So it's not just a matter of encountering them or reading about them. It's a matter of what kind of personal relationship you want to develop with them. And that personal relationship, in order for the teachings to be effective, in order for them to be able to do what the Buddha intended them to do, have to be taken in and held in a way that honors who you truly are, your deepest sense of self. Self-care in contemplating the Buddha's teachings means creating a sense of inner sanctuary or inner refuge, a calm, quiet place within us where we come to do this important work. And this work really needs to begin with a certain amount of self-compassion. Because what we are agreeing to do is to look at, to contemplate things that the discursive mind doesn't really want to do. The fact that it's not going to be around forever, that it's subject to change, and at some point it will end. So this sense of refuge, this vantage point from which we can contemplate these teachings, can happen in two ways. It does happen in two ways. One is the creation of our refuge around us, okay? And that is exactly what we do when we come together on Sunday nights. We co-create Sangha. We co-create a place of refuge. We take refuge in the Sangha, which is to say, we come together and we agree to relax the mind to the point where we can take in these teachings that under most circumstances the mind is not particularly interested in hearing. Yeah. We do so in the interest of our spiritual well-being, in the interest of spiritual maturation. Right? Instead of agreeing to block out that which is difficult to look at, instead we're kind of doing just the opposite. Historically, the importance of creating this place for refuge. It's useful to look back on the Buddha's early experience in offering these teachings. As I discussed here before, one of the kind of core principles in the aesthetics of Chinese landscape painting, for instance, is something that's also found in ethology and the study of animal behavior. And it's the concept of what's called refuge and prospect. And what that means is that most animal species, especially those who might, under some circumstances, be either predator or prey, but in order to survive as a species, one of the things that is sought after by many mammals and members of the animal kingdom are these two qualities of being in terms of their spatial relationship to their environment. One is refuge, that one is able to situate oneself in a place of safety, of protection, free from harm. The other is what's called prospect, which is the ability to perceive what's going on around, to be able to scan the environment, the landscape, and to recognize threats and opportunities. So Chinese landscape painting is almost never from the standpoint, the vantage point of somebody down in the valley looking up into a forest, looking up into a canyon, or looking up at a castle or a structure. It almost always is from the vantage point of some elevation, oftentimes as if you're on a mountainside across the valley from what it is you're looking at, whether it's a building or another one or something like that. So it's the sense of being in a place where you have a clear view, okay, but where you yourself are also sheltered. And so, in undertaking this work, it turns out that something that is likewise really important for us is that we have that sense of refuge and prospect. So, whether it's refuge in the Sangha, and the way we contemplate these things together, the way we speak of them, the way we study them, or refuge within yourself, which is to say, examining these teachings from a perspective of kindness and self-compassion and self-care. You know, both those things are really important because what we are doing when we take up the study of these teachings is that we are looking at, we're agreeing to contemplate ways of understanding the mind and ways of understanding our existence that are not in keeping with how we've been raised in our culture, not in keeping with how we've been enculturated, not in keeping with how we've been taught that things are permanent and stable, and that includes us, you know, and we are the same being start to finish, and, you know, unchangeable, unshakable, right? And so is everything else, and it's the mind's quest for certainty and stability and protection from the fears that come along, can come along, with acknowledging everything is in flux, and nothing is forever, and nothing is ultimately stable or with substance. Because to really open yourself to those observations is a little destabilizing. It's kind of nervous-making, right? The importance of self-care was something that was really brought home to the Buddha himself not long after he began to teach. As he was finding his own path, you know, he was an ascetic of extraordinary discipline and extraordinary motivation. And he drove himself nearly to death's door. You know, he was part of an ascetic tradition that it felt as if the body was the enemy of the soul or the spirit. You know, that the body was full of defilements and that it was untrustworthy. You know, a lot different from the way, you know, the body was located in the Christian tradition, especially in the early Middle Ages. It was really to be distrusted. It was foul. It was really the root of all our problems. And that somehow or another, if you could, you know, starve the body to the point of collapse, you know, you attain some kind of purified state that would then free the mind. And so the Buddha was following that path ardently until he realized he was on the verge of death. He was, you know, coming up on starving himself to death, you know. And at that point, he realized that, you know, because he was saying, well, why is there this suffering? What's going on? What's causing this? And at some point, it dawned on him. It's like, oh, it's Wapashi. It's me. It's my own unskillful craving. You know, it's the ego that is going to either attain enlightenment or die trying. And so then he had to say, in order for true freedom to be attained, is it possible for the ego to die, but the body to sit around to experience freedom? And he realized, yes, it is. So his own sense of revulsion and distrust of the body and its urges and its fears and its cravings and whatnot, I had brought him to the brink of annihilation. And then he realized that it was the mind's relationship to the body and not the body itself that was the problem. And so he took this alternate path. You know, he nourished himself. He gained some respect for this vehicle and its ability to achieve what he wanted to, if he was respectful of it. And so that's what ultimately made it possible for him to attain enlightenment, is regain some sense of self-care, of the need to really have kind regard for the thing that we are this time around. Unfortunately, some of his earliest and most ardent, most highly motivated students somehow didn't quite get the memo because they went at it just like the Buddha did. You know, fierce determination to become free in his lifetime. And wound up doing a lot of the same ascetic practices when they were doing the mindfulness practices, when they were doing, you know, contemplating the three characteristics, when they were doing the type daily recollections and others. They came to be able to see more and more and more clearly how the habits of mind create dukkha, create dissatisfaction, create the suffering that they had vowed to bring to an end. And the harder they practiced, the more they looked at what was going on in the mind, the more determined they were to compel the mind to cease acting in that way, to try to compel the mind by force of will to be free of attachment, aversion, and delusion, the more aversive they became to their own minds. And unfortunately, when they came to that same fork in the road that the Buddha had, they went down the other path. The path of stronger and stronger self-aversion, the path of less and less trust in this process as it is, the path that contains no deeper wisdom or compassion. And some of them wound up committing suicide as a result. Their sense of self-revulsion rose to almost a sense of panic. You know, I'm incapable of keeping the mind from causing the suffering. Therefore, perhaps this being ought no longer to exist. And when they began to do that, not a lot of them, but some of them did, and the Buddha had a hard look at why, at what state of mind was that they were in, he realized he kind of overdone it. You know, he was advocating the same hard effort that he had undertaken, but he didn't have the wisdom or the self-compassion to see when they needed to go down the other path. And so he really began to adopt some corrective teachings. What he saw happening among his followers was that they were focusing only on the aspects of mind that were causing them to suffer, and only on the aspects of mind that occasionally caused them to speak or act in unskillful ways. Focus only on the ways that they're causing suffering for themselves. And he realized that was creating a really strong imbalance in their view of themselves. It in some ways was the antithesis of self-care, because they had become incapable of seeing the ways that through their efforts, they were in fact learning to be more insightful and less inclined to speak or act unskillfully, and less inclined to harm others. Because what happens is those of us, you know, who've been undertaking this practice, what we know is that as we tune ourselves in to our own sources of dukkha and the way that we sometimes unconsciously perpetuate the way we speak or act, when we begin to awaken to the effects of our actions, the cause-effect relationship between how we speak or act and that as a result, we become more and more sensitized to the harm that we cause ourselves and others. This practice has the effect of heightening feelings of empathy for ourselves and for others. And so something that, you know, a few years ago, we may have done thoughtlessly or without any even ability to reflect on the ramifications of our actions, somehow now, if we do the same thing, we immediately become more aware. Look what I've done. Look at the harm I've caused. And so the more sensitized you become, in essence, even though it's painful, the less likely we progressively become to create new suffering. And the more likely we become to lead lives of integrity and lives of non-harming and lives of deeper insight and understanding into ourselves and others. And so that's actually what's going on, but the Buddha saw that his followers were not seeing that. They were only focusing on the ways they were screwing up, and they were not focusing on the ways they were cleaning up their act, and the ways they were actually being kinder to others, and the ways they were actually being more generous. You know, and so one of the practices that the Buddha started teaching, and he said, you know, just like you do these other practices that provide insight into how the mind creates suffering, you really need to start practicing acknowledgement of the merits of your beneficial Buddhist beliefs. You really need to start looking at the cause-effect relationship between your efforts to live a life of integrity and a life of kindness, in a life that spiritually starts to ground generosity, you really need to start to acknowledge the merits of your good deeds. He said that's just as important as looking at the other. Because otherwise you wind up with this really distorted view of yourself. You know? a view of yourself that is not kind, that is not supportive, that is not understanding, that is not characterized by self-compassion. And he said, if you find yourself in that place, in that place of sort of self-negation, you know, or negative self-judgment, he said, that's not what I had in mind when I shared these teachings. You know, it's to gain insight into the ways we cause suffering for ourselves and others. But it's equally important to gain insight into how, through our speech and action, we can be a benefit to others and the ways that we are. So to acknowledge that. You know, just take it. Acknowledge the fact that there lies within you beneficial intention and an innate yearning for freedom from suffering or your suffering needs. And then many of your actions are actually inclined in that direction. You notice or not. So learning to develop some balanced sense of self-regard, you know, so number one, super important. Another practice that he taught that is, in my experience, quite important, quite necessary for taking on these powerful teachings of impermanence and insubstantiality is the capacity for residing and cultivating a sense of and being able to reside in a sense of compassion for oneself and others, for being able to experience joy, for being able to experience peace of mind, for being able to experience open-heartedness and generosity. Anicca and Anatta, change and insubstantiality, are not all bad news. You know, here in, you know, this beautiful place where we live, you know, at dawn and at dusk, especially in days when there's a few clouds in the sky, you know, if you wake up in the morning and you see, you know, the light begin to soften and brighten, and you see the pink clouds, and you sense the stillness of the earth during this period of change, this period of transition from the dark to the day. Okay. There's an exquisite beauty about that. You know, when it's available to you, this kind of sense of joy that just arises with being a part of that. Same is true in the transition period of sunset. My brother and several of my family for a lot of years lived in Hawaii, and wherever we happened to be on one of the islands, if we happened to be down on the beach at sunset, wherever we were, whatever people were there, you know, by and large, they stopped reading their novels or they stopped playing frisbee or whatever, and then we just stood there. Look at the sunset, you know, and we just share it. We just, you know, it's like we're all in church or something. We're all kind of in awe of what was going on in the sky. And all we were doing was honoring that change, you know, the change from day to night. But, you know, you look at the clouds, they look like they had substance right there. You know, they're looking at the sky still, and they're white, and they're pink, and you know, one of them looks like a dog, and another one looks like, you know, the Starship Enterprise or whatever. But they're real, right? They're real clouds. Well, you know, not so much. So you kind of roll by, and you come into being, and they go away, and they change shape, and whatnot. But these are just manifestations of anicca and anatta, of ceaseless change and insubstantiality. So, you know, those lessons are all around us. Some of them are quite beautiful, and some of them are quite touching, and some of them are real bummer. If it turns out we've got some life-threatening illness, you know, or all of our vibrant break our collarbone, that's change. bar, and our clavicle wasn't quite as substantial as it go to my feet. So these phenomena come to us in all these different forms, some of which we judge to be pleasant, and we are attracted to it, others which we are severely bummed out by. But being able to take them in from this perspective of self-compassion, of tasting the joy when it's there, when it's available, of being able to experience the difficult without aversion and the pleasant without attachment. You know, that's the refuge and the prospect. You know, we call those the Brahma Viharas, you know, the divine abodes. So the ability to perceive the world from the perspective of those states of mind, it makes it possible to take in anything, see some change and substantiality. So, contemplating aging, you know, can involve, you know, again, grieving the loss of some aspects of our capacity or whatever. But the flip side of that, for me sometimes, is kind of what last handful, I think, you know, of certain things seem to be declining or no longer possible, but it is yet possible to really find joy in and take pleasure in and be nourished by, be inspired by what we still can do. You know, the ability just to take in the day, the ability to be with each other in a kind and meaningful way. You know, one of the things that comes with age and experience is a deepening understanding of the richness of life. You know, the Buddha, when he was talking about people when they quarrel, you know, said, people forget that their lives will end soon. And they remember, quarrels come to a halt. this expanded perspective oftentimes is something that only comes with a certain amount of life experience. Contemplation of death. I've, you know, speaking with people about this, I've had a lot of folks tell me, well, you know, I'm much less bothered by or concerned about or afraid of the prospect of no longer being around nearly as much as I am the process by which I get there. So it isn't fear of death so much as it is fear of dying, you know? What's that going to be about? You know, under what circumstances is that going to occur? Will I die in fear? Will I die in pain? Will I die in the presence of my loved ones? Hopefully it's going to send some really good drugs. We don't know. We don't know what the circumstances are going to be. You know, the only two things we know about death is that the certainty of its occurrence and the uncertainty of the circumstances. And so that's simply something that we need to, you know, make our peace with. And it's in this regard that the Buddha's teachings about anatta, not self, can be the most valuable and important and powerful. The Buddha talked often about what he called the deathless. You know, that which was not born can never die. And so, it's a state of compassionate awareness that has no beginning and has no end, because it's not a product of the discursive mind. It was not created by self. It's not a product of self. It's a state of mind that is without self. Thus, it was not born, and it cannot die. So, in the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and greater, the Tibetan Book of the Great Liberation on Hearing the Bargo is the formal title of it. And it's the phrases that are read to someone who is dying, is entering the bargo of dying, by a spiritual friend or a family member, or a guide, someone that the person dying goes to trust also. And those phrases are things like, oh noble being, you who are the son or daughter of the Lord. that's not who I am. That's something that the mind generates, you know, when it's useful, and sometimes it generates when it's not, right? But that's not who I truly am. It's our ability, and it's a government she spoke the Tibetan Book of Loving and Dying. He said, you know, to the extent possible, it's wonderful if we can learn the lessons that the Tibetan Book of the Great Liberation has to offer. Not when we're relying on some swag to get ready to check out, but now, if we can learn to let go of this notion of self, now, if we can learn to experience the deathless, now, then whenever our time comes, it won't necessarily be over. That's why, you know, fairly deep Buddha Dharma practice is sometimes referred to as death practice. You know, because we're practicing letting go of self in the moment. And when we do that, it becomes more and more possible to live in the moment. Not with anticipation, not with regret, just in the moment. And the more completely we can do that, then we begin to discover the more the capacity for freedom begins to emerge. Well, I didn't leave as much time as I intended for some discussion and exchange, but please, anything I've said that, you know, has raised a question or a thought, this is a good time to share it if you want to. Please.
Do you want to say So you talked a lot about, like, you know, ceaseless change and insubstantiality, and but then also, like, self-care and care for others. And so, like, sometimes I get caught in this where, like, I get caught thinking about the insubstantiality of things, and so then I get confused of, like, how am I supposed to, like, love myself and others when there's, you know, there's not really a self here, or there's not really others here.
Yes.
How do you kind of balance that?
That's a very good question, thank you. Right. How do we live with this, what seems like this kind of split screen, sort of now you see it, now you don't, you know, with regard to something? Because fellow philosophers who were trying to challenge the Buddha's views would really come at him and say, okay, is there, you know, is there an ultimate reality, or is there, you know, what happens when you die, basically, you know? Is there a permanent by yourself, or we just all this, you know, evaporate, and that's the end of the story, you know, which is, and his, you know, you basically would engage in those dialogues, and then people would go away because they realized they weren't able to recruit into their team. And then his followers would say, well, you know, why did you see someone or another? They weren't asking the right questions, they couldn't have understood my answer. He said, the self cannot be said to exist, nor can the self be said to not exist. The self exists when the mind creates it. Essentially. And we notice the mind creates self all the time. Whether we want it or not, it just does it. And so one of the real values of mindfulness meditation, when we, you know, when we really start to handle it, is that instead of kind of believing the story, believing what the discursive mind is telling us about who we are, we can step to one side a little bit. Say, oh, okay, here's mind creating stuff, right? And we are in this process of living the reality of sometimes being strong and being with the sense of self, you know, and expressing our views and opinions and, you know, taking a stand and whatnot. And then at other times, softening and stepping back and seeing what the mind is doing. One of the analogies the Buddha used for spiritual awakening, and it's a fairly non-dualistic, I think, and helpful view of self. He said, imagine that, you know, there is a, like a hen house, and there are hens that are sitting on their eggs, and they are incubating them. Because within the egg, there is this chick that is gradually consuming its food source within the egg. It's growing, and at the same time it's consuming its food source, the shell of the egg is getting thinner, and it's getting more brittle, and the chick is getting stronger. And eventually, the egg becomes thinner and more fragile and more brittle at the same time that the chick is becoming bigger and stronger, and it's outgrowing this protective vessel that brought it into life, that brought it into being. And it starts clawing and pecking at the interior of the shell. And eventually, it cracks it open, and it pulls it apart, and it emerges. So that's one way to think about spiritual maturation, spiritual development, that there is this sort of vehicle that brought us to a certain point in time, right? It got us to a certain stage in our development. And having done so, we've now gotten to the point where we got grounded. It's performed its function. And now that it has performed its function, all it's really doing is constraining us. It's encapsulating and imprisoning us. And so the effort, the spiritual effort right now, is the same as that chick. So we're doing what we can to break free of that which at one point provided an important function, but now is no longer needed. But this is a process that goes on for quite a long time. And as you know, wild birds as well as, chickens and whatever, that period of hatching, of coming forth into the world, is a very delicate time. And it's a time when the chicks are quite vulnerable, because they are in transition. They're experiencing anicca. They're experiencing change. They're experiencing transformation from one substance or one form of being into another. Okay. And biologists tell us they're doing that every second, of course, but that's an important kind of milestone transition period when they first make that change. And so when I talk about the importance of self-care as we engage in spiritual inquiry and spiritual maturation, spiritual work, the effort that goes into really contemplating the five daily revelations, the importance of remembering that we are kind of like that chick, that we are in the process of rebirthing ourselves into a new understanding of what it means to be who we are. What this mind-body process is all about. Thank you for your question. And I'm running out of time, one more time. So let's take our sitting posture just once more. And we'll call on our friends to help oversee our process of spiritual emergence. Okay.
Night, everybody. Safe ride home.